Hey everyone, welcome back to Southern Fried Storytime. As you may have noticed, I haven't had any ads lately. My sponsorship with Anchor has expired and they're currently seeking a new sponsor for me. In the meantime, if you want to support the show, I'm told there's a link for listener support in the show notes of each episode, so you can contribute there. That's Anchor FM. Look for Southern Fried Storytime and click on the link in the show notes for the episode. That being said, I'm very aware that the current economy is pretty rough. I consider us friends, and if you're going through financial hardship, especially right now around Christmas, I definitely understand if a financial contribution is not within your means right now. Things are tight for people, right? And I totally get it. You can still help this podcast without donating a dime. Just like, subscribe, share it with your friends, engage with us on Facebook and on my WordPress page, and just help the podcast get around. That's really the most helpful thing you can do. For it, we have seen a great increase in listeners through the last year. Interestingly, my countries where I'm listened to the most are Canada and the UK, according to my wrap-up information for the year, which surprised me a lot. Thank you, guys. I'm really excited about that, just because I thought the only person listening was my mom. So I'm super excited about that. I can't tell you how grateful I am that people are out there listening. Usually in the afternoon, so I hope you're all driving safely out there on your commute. But really, truly, the most helpful thing you can do for the podcast is to help us pop up a little more in those Google searches, help us beat the algorithms, and just like and subscribe and leave reviews and, you know, all of the usual stuff that every single podcast and YouTube channel is begging you for right now. It really does help, as weird as that sounds. So I'm really appreciate the great numbers, the great improvement we've seen through this last year, and how much you guys are actually appreciating getting to hear these beautiful ancient stories from all over the world. It's so fascinating to see that other people besides myself are equally driven by these kind of classic stories and, of course, classic monsters, which makes me inspired to just continue even more. I really appreciate you guys tuning in, you know, with me a couple times a week and taking time out of your very busy day to just join me in the fantasy world for a little bit. It's more fun than the real one. What can I say? So thank you again. You can always listen to the podcast for free on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Breaker, CastBox, Pocket Casts, Radio Public, Spotify, and of course, Anchor. So anytime you want to hear me, the show is free, and I would be happy to spend some time with you. And now, TuneIn Radio also has agreed to host the podcast, so I have a whole nother platform that I'm available on. It is also free, and I look forward to talking to you there as well. Today, we're going to talk about Grilla and the Yule Lads. So rather than an actual story, we're going to do a Monster Minute per se. When I say monster minute for any of my monster episodes, it's kind of using the word monster loosely. I suppose if it weren't already trademarked, I'd say they're fantastic beasts. You know where to find them. These ones, you'd find them in Iceland. So we're back in Iceland again. Interesting. Our first recorded tale of Grilla comes from the 13th century prose Edda. This is the same text where we get most of our information about Thor and Loki and kind of all of those other staples of Norse mythology. Boy, my THs are bugging me today, huh? Yep, it's just all a bunch of dysfunctional families and weirdos like today's stars of Monster Minute. So let's go ahead and meet that family. Grilla is a giant or giantess. In some versions, she's called an ogress. You know, there's lots of translations coming over from Icelandic languages, especially ancient languages. So you'll see, just like with Rapunzel, a ogress slash giantess, sometimes a gigas. These things kind of blur together. But anyway, giant, super strong lady, right? And her children are smaller than her, and it's said that they are the size of buildings. So yeah, definitely. Grilla's big, big girl. She has 15 leathery tails, white pus-filled bulbs on her face. And so I guess she's a teenager. And she just loves to eat naughty children. She lives in a cave on the volcanic lava flows in Iceland, where she still keeps tabs on naughty children. I'm not sure if this is like Santa Claus's magic snowball, where he can see you if you're sleeping. But with Grilla, that comes off as even more creepy. I don't know. Anyway, somehow she keeps tabs on naughty children. I couldn't find any specifics in the three different versions I read through. It just says that she hears them. So apparently she's got super good hearing, I guess. I don't know. Around Christmas, when the nights are long and dark, I'm feeling that right now, guys, in Iceland, not so much in Iceland, though, they used to believe that the barriers between our world and the world of the Huldufólk grows thin, similar to the Celtic beliefs about Halloween. At this time, Grilla will either leave her cave or send her sons and her cat to stuff the naughty children in a bag and bring them down, up to her home, where she makes them into a stew. Now, I can relate to that whole ominous feeling when it feels like most of your day is actually night. It's kind of funny. I used to live really far up north, and one of my greatest laments about the winter was not only the incredible bitter cold, but the fact that, you know, your day was pretty much over at about 4:30 p.m. It started getting dark, and it was very, very frustrating because you feel like the sun just came up and now it's telling you goodnight, you know. And so I moved down here to South Carolina, and while it is much, much warmer in the winter, you usually just need a light jacket. What surprised me, and this is just my own ignorance, I didn't look into it at all before I came down here, so the days are just as short. So, you know, I guess it makes sense. I'm still in the northern hemisphere, so, you know, when you think about it, it's pretty brain dead that it never occurred to me. But for some reason, my brain just associated warmth with the daylight, and I assumed that because it was going to be warm longer, that the days were going to be longer. Nope. Down here in the south, the sun still sets at like 5:15 in the evening. So you're just stuck with night for the rest of the day. It's just one of those things that, when I think about it now, it's obvious, but for some reason, just the idea that even though it was warmer, it would still get dark early just never occurred to me, which is incredibly foolish. But then I guess I really didn't give it that much thought at all. I was mostly thinking about getting away from the cold. So it's just one of those things where you kind of facepalm your forehead going, why did I not think of that? But I didn't. And I can see why the night just seeming to stretch on and on and on would be the inspiration for the belief that the barrier between our world and the world of fantasy creatures kind of would thin out and become a little more easily permeable, I guess, is what I want to say, and easy to pass through. Like I said, this is pretty common that we see in some of the Celtic beliefs surrounding Samhain and Halloween, where they think that the realm between our world and the Fae come closer together. This is very, very similar to that, except it takes place around Christmas when the nights are dark and long, and they believe that the Huldufólk can cross between our world a little bit more easily this time of year. And I'm just monologuing about this because I can honestly say when those nights get so, so long like that, you can definitely see where this kind of belief would come from, especially if you are somebody who tends to be a little more uncomfortable when it's dark, a little more suspicious of things creeping up on you in the dark. I can just see how this time of year, when it gets dark so much earlier, would be a bit more uncomfortable. You'd be a little bit more on alert, and that seems to kind of be the case here. But this puts Grilla firmly into the kind of boogeyman category, meaning a cultural monster whose purpose is to scare kids into behaving well. My first story that I did back when I had the Shivering Mouse podcast about such a similar creature was the Boogeyman. And at that time, you know, it was a Disney-based podcast, so I was doing Oogie Boogie from The Nightmare Before Christmas. And at that point, I discovered that Boogeymen are just kind of a whole big general category. There are a couple specific kind of Boogeyman legends, but for the most part, Boogeyman is just a whole category of monsters used specifically for the purpose of scaring kids straight, right? Like keeping them on the straight and narrow path with terror. So Grilla falls into that category, right up there with the Hispanic La Llorona story and Krampus, the Bog Beast of Baku in Guild Wars. These are your classic stories of keeping the kitties safe and well behaved by making them believe that if they don't, they'll die and or go to hell. It's a little harsh, but you know, it's how people do back then, I guess. Yeah, it's pretty intense, but they kind of had to do what they had to do. One could argue that in some sense, the big bad wolf is kind of another representation of this in like the, as there's a lot of big bad wolves in Little Red Riding Hood specifically, because she disobeyed orders, she was the victim of the big bad wolf. But big bad wolf is more personified than a boogeyman. Usually boogeymen are just kind of a figure of absolute terror, whereas the big bad wolf could be outsmarted, so it's a little bit more vanquishable. I don't think that's a word. I might have just made it up. But it's something you can overcome, whereas a boogeyman is a force that you absolutely cannot defeat, and it is kind of a reckoning of your bad decisions. I'm a big proponent of the fact that choices have consequences for the better or for the worse. So in that sense, the boogeyman, I'm kind of on board with it. But on the other hand, again, since it's made specifically to frighten children, it makes me a little uncomfortable. I'm not going to lie about that, because you're terrifying children of real world things and of making their own independent choices. But children are children and have parents because they're really not great at making independent choices. So kind of on the fence on the whole boogeyman thing, but Grilla falls into my category of boogeymen. She, despite being a lady, exists purely to scare kids into being well behaved. In the 18th century, it became illegal for parents to use stories of Grilla to scare their kids. No word yet as to whether juvenile delinquency has increased now that the parents can no longer, you know, scare their kids into believing that they can be eaten by a woman the size of a building and her equally massive cat if they misbehave. But maybe, I mean, the whole idea of scaring these kids was that then they would behave. So one would expect, once it was no longer legal to terrify your children into nightmares, that suddenly they would feel there were no consequences and start misbehaving. I don't know. I also don't know how you enforce that kind of law when, you know, how much control do you have over the stories that parents tell their kids at night? If you're from North Korea, don't tell me the answer to that. I prefer not to know. That situation makes me sad. Next in the family, we have Grilla's spineless beta male husband. I'm going to slaughter this name. I'm just going to go ahead and my apologies to anybody in Europe who may be listening to this. I'm totally open to you guys correcting me. It's spelled very interesting. I found like three different spellings of this name. I think it's Lepaludi or Lepalaudi. I'm not sure. Again, I had known nothing about Icelandic language other than it looks incredibly complicated, but it's an interesting name, but I'm just, frankly, I have no idea how to pronounce it, but this guy is a total beta. As is common in folklore, when the man of the house fails to wear the pants and take care of his family, then the wife kind of goes completely power hungry. And he allows her to follow her worst impulses and for those impulses to take over. You see a lot of this in fairy tales. They need to be... Fairy tales put a lot of influence on married couples having a real balance. And I think that that's great. Anytime you see one member of any spousal relationship kind of taking over, the dominant member of that unhealthy, unbalanced relationship always seems to immediately turn to evil. I don't know what it is, but you see in a lot of the Jack and the Giant Slayer, there's a whole series of Jack stories, but any stories with Jack and the Giant or Tom Thumb where the husband is the dominant character, he's of course very evil and ominous and terrifying, specifically Jack and the Beanstalk. And any time where the wife is the dominant spouse, you also see then she goes totally power hungry. So I'm just going to take this as rather being like a gender criticism as just that these relationships require a certain amount of balance, and also kind of a statement that people that are kind of dominant power hungry people will display that dominance not only in their outward lives, but at home with their spouse. We do see this a few episodes in Cinderella where the stepmother took over the house and Cinderella's father just kind of backed off and let her totally terrorize his daughter, even calling his daughter the scullery wench or the kitchen wench at the end. So it's like he's almost become so brainwashed and gaslit that he has no idea at the end of the story that this is his own daughter, somebody he should be protecting. And again, that's a relationship where the wife is the dominant one. So we see this in fairy tale stories. If the marital relationship is out of balance, then often that person who is the dominant figure becomes a very power-hungry, corrupt person in other aspects of their life. And we see that a lot with Grilla and her husband. He never contradicts her. I'm not sure if he's totally on board with begging and eating children. It really doesn't state much of his wishes, but that's in keeping with this character, who's a pretty pathetic soy boy who doesn't mind her evil ways as long as it's not directed at him. He's pathetic, lazy. He's kind of a sad sack guy, honestly, and he will not be stopping his demon wife from eating children anytime soon. He totally doesn't care. Every description I could find of him is just him sitting in his chair by the fire, giving no craps about anything. Like, this dude is pathetic. On the other hand, kind of an alpha chick like Grilla would probably marry a guy like this because she's instantly the boss babe. She doesn't have to deal with communicating with this fellow or bargaining with this fellow, negotiating and being on equal ground. When you are a dominant person, you seek a submissive spouse. And Grilla, she got a Yahtzee on that one. This guy, like I said, he's a sad, pitiful soy boy who just sits there. And not only does he not raise any fuss against Grilla and her child eating, stew making, sinner ways, but he also does not, like, support her or put in any effort in procuring said children or any other kind of food either. He's kind of just there, and it's that almost bothers me more than him being a co-conspirator in her evil, is that he doesn't even have the gumption to do that. He just sits there and eats children with her. It is the weirdest. Oh, these stories are strange. This Norse mythology stuff, man, it's weird. Anyway, now we have probably the most interesting part, and it's her children, the Yule lads. These are her 13 giant sons. These boys are trouble, but they are nowhere near as dangerous as their mom. They're trouble in kind of that Loki, Coyote, Anansi, trickster, prank playing, Br'er Rabbit kind of trouble, as opposed to Grilla, who's gonna eat you. You know, one is definitely a much bigger threat than the other. However, the Yule lads are kind of her field hands, if you will. Like, if you're a bad enough kid, they will bring you back for her to eat rather than her coming down to get you herself. So in that sense, they can be frightening, but they do tend to be a lot more merciful than Grilla herself. They would rather play pranks than victimize anybody. But then, of course, after they play a prank, they feel badly about it. So if you've been a good kid and you leave out a shoe for them, the lads will put in gifts in your shoe as an apology for their mischief. This is one of many, many kind of Christmas references we see to the many different Christmas creatures, elves, monsters that we see around the holiday that will use shoes or stockings to deposit gifts in. So we tend to associate that specifically with Santa Claus. But the more research I've done on different creatures for this season, it just kind of strikes me how that's kind of a continuing theme. What is with people in shoes and stockings? I don't know. But it runs from almost all of these stories. There's some kind of leave a gift in your shoe or your stocking situation happening, no matter how strange and separate and disparate these stories may be. I don't know why. Just making a note of it. If you've been a little less than ideal, like if your room is untidy, the Yule lads will leave a moldy potato in your shoe. Guys, I would way rather have the lump of coal than a moldy potato. Have you smelled a moldy potato? Goodness gracious. The only thing worse is a moldy tomato. That's so yucky. Oh my goodness. But then, as I mentioned before, if you were really, really, really bad, then they will take you home to meet their mama, which is we're just saying not in like a fun way. This is bad. But they do think you're a keeper if they take you home to mama. Probably not as much of a compliment in this context, though. Each of these 13 sons are named after a particular quirk or characteristic that they have. For example, Sheepcoat Clod likes to harass sheep. It doesn't say specifically how, just that he likes to harass sheep, but he lacks the agility to do so because he has two peg legs. He tends to come on the scene December 12th. December 13, you can look forward to seeing Gully Gawk, who steals cow milk. December 14, there's Stufer, or Stubby, a little shorty who loves to come in and steal pots and pans to eat any food that may be stuck to them. Spoon Licker is extremely thin and loves to lick the food off wooden spoons. He likes to show up on the scene around December 15. Pot Scraper steals leftovers from pots. Again, December 16. December 17, you get Bowl Licker, who steals bowls and eats their contents, usually hiding under your bed until he sees his opportunity to sneak out and steal whatever's going on in your bowls that night. December 18, you get Door Slammer. This would irritate me, guys. Like, I would definitely require a present in my sock after this. Likes to slam doors at night to keep the household awake. What a stinker. I don't like that. Nope. I like my sleep. To me, sleep is even more important than food. Like, don't mess with my sleeping. Nope. I don't like that guy. December 19, we get Skyr Gobbler. This guy eats all of the skyr. Skyr is like a thick, amazing Icelandic yogurt. It's kind of like Greek yogurt in that it's really like double fermented and very thick and rich. It's almost like a cross between regular yogurt and cheesecake. It's very rich, very delicious. Usually not too high up on too many carbs unless you get the ones that are really, really flavored and processed. But Skyr is good. I'd be mad at this guy too. So he kind of fills me with a little bit of rage, but not as much as the one who's keeping me up at night. It's not okay. December 20, we get Sausage Swiper. He hides in the rafters of smokehouses and steals sausages. Sausage is kind of expensive, so it's a super annoying thing to do. December 21, cream of the crop here, guys. We have Window Peeper. Do I even have to describe that? Ew. Ew, ew. No. Nope. No. December 22, we get Doorway Sniffer. It's a terrible name, really. I would not want to be called Doorway Sniffer. Change your name, bro. He has a massive nose and sniffs around looking for leaf breads, which is like an Icelandic bread, I guess. So he likes his carbs, Doorway Sniffer. December 23, we get Meat Hook, who uses a metal hook to steal meat. So this guy's on the keto diet. December 24, we have Candle Stealer. He follows children in order to steal their tallow or beef fat candles, also called a dip candle, if you remember from the Christmas Carol episode. Scrooge talks about climbing the stairs with his dip candle. Those are tallow candles. Those are made pretty much out of fat, so they are edible. So we've got another keto contender here, watching those macros, I guess. They all arrive on the dates that I listed, and each of them sticks around for 13 days. So from December 12 to January 6, parents can look forward to their kids behaving out of absolute terror. Nice. So you're milking almost a whole month out of that. Way to go, Mom and Dad. Most of them exist to keep tidiness at the forefront of kids' minds. You may have noticed that too as I was looking in at everything that these Yule lads are up to. Most of them center around like food that's been left in bowls, left on spoons, stuff like that. So just make sure you're washing your dishes before you go to bed, I guess. And then of course they won't leave a gift if your room is untidy. So a lot of this has to do with trying to encourage kids to help out around the house. Makes perfect sense when you consider that in most countries that celebrate Christmas, this is probably one of the busiest times of year for a lot of people. So they want their kids to help out around the house more. And what will accomplish that goal? Like abject terror. Most of them exist, to just kind of help parents keep the house clean by having the kids do it. This also encourages the kids to not only do their chores, but to do them well, because like when we talk about the guy who steals pots and pans and eats the stuff that's stuck on them, if you've got cast iron, you've got to really clean those stinkers to get that stuff off. So if you don't want your pot liquor guy to come in and sneak into your house, you've got to really do those chores well, not just dunk the dish in water and put it up and be like, okay, I'm off to my PlayStation now. Nope, it's not how that works. So as we continue to weave our stories through the Christmas season, you know, definitely clean your room, tidy your kitchen, or you may find yourself facing Grilla and the ULEDs, and nobody wants somebody slamming doors in their house all night. We need sleep, right? So like, subscribe, share, check out our Facebook page and WordPress.com page. That's what you can do the most to help this podcast, and that way you can learn how you can avoid running into Grilla and her 13 horrible sons and mildly annoying husband. Thanks for tuning in today, and have a wonderful Christmas. Hey everyone, welcome back to Southern Fried Storytime. As you may have noticed, I haven't had any sponsored ads lately, and just to reiterate without going into too much detail, you can of course go to Anchor FM, search up my podcast, and sponsor me directly there until Anchor is able to find another sponsor for me. However, in the meantime, let's just jump right into our Christmas episodes. This is my favorite time of year to tell stories because Christmas and Halloween always just seem to have the most fun stories and creatures, and oh, it's just a good time. I get really excited about it. I know that's probably not the cool, stylish way to be, but yeah, I'm perfectly content to nerd out at Christmas. I love it so much. I love the smells of the good food and candles and presents and cinnamon, and the decorations are so bright, and stuff on TV seems a little more wholesome than it usually is, except this guy. You've been waiting for him, and you knew I had to talk about him because we've been talking about monsters and stuff. So naturally, this time of year, here he is. It's Krampus. Krampus kind of serves as a punisher or disciplinarian for naughty children instead of Saint Nicholas himself. Now, in modern versions of the Saint Nicholas story, at least here in America, we have Saint Nick kind of serving the dual purpose of he'll give you a gift if you're good, but he'll give you a lump of coal if you were not so good. Classically, though, in some parts of the world, Saint Nick was sent to hit the road with a companion of sorts. And depending on where you're from, sometimes that punishing companion was Krampus. This was partially so that Saint Nicholas, who's seen as kind of a kind and benevolent person, who is the patron saint of children, would not be seen as someone who was then giving punishment to children. You know, that dualism, I guess, was a little bit hard to deal with. And the reason why is partially because the punishments were so much more harsh at this time. You know, instead of just getting a piece of coal, you might be beaten with a stick. And they didn't want to tie that to Saint Nicholas at the time. And I'll go into that in further detail in my St. Nicholas episode. You know there's going to be one, and it's there's a lot. There's a lot there, actually. I found a lot more for him than I did for Krampus. Krampus is half goat and half demon, covered in fur, usually a very dark colored fur. Usually it's somewhat unkempt fur. Also, he kind of looks kind of gross. Looks like he needs a bath. He has cloven hooves and horns and a long red tongue that is always kind of hanging out there like he doesn't have the strength to pull it back inside his mouth. I don't know. It's gross. I don't just like on Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, how Barty Crouch always did that weird thing with his mouth because he's trying not to act like he's Doctor Who anymore. I don't know, but stop it. The mouth stuff is gross, and people with misophonia are going to go nuts when they hear all those yucky mouth noises. It's not cool, man. Now, sometimes, instead of having both feet be cloven hooves, he'll have one kind of misdirected human foot that's, like, turned to the side or even backwards, and then one cloven hoof. It's weird. I don't know what it's symbolic of, but it's weird. And it definitely distinguishes him from other kind of satyr images that you would see in like Greek mythology or pagan worship. He's got a weird foot thing going on. I don't know. See a podiatrist, friend. I don't know. Maybe he needs to see a horseshoer. I'm not sure. He needs to see somebody because that's not, that can't be good for like your walking posture. He's probably got some hip and back trouble going on. Anyway, he carries chains and a birch stick for beating children, as we mentioned, and a sack for kidnapping him. So he carries a lot of stuff with him, sounds like. Some say that these bad children go home with him for him to eat, like Grilla, and others say that the children go straight to hell, which neither of these are great options. I mean, let's be real. Honestly, I just don't know. Eating would probably be the better option because then at some point there would come an end to your pain, whereas the whole idea of hell is suffering forever, right? Sometimes the chains that he's seen carrying with him are supposed to be symbolic of a biblical reference to chaining up the devil or binding the devil with chains, but it is kind of specifically implied that Krampus himself is not the actual devil, so I'm a little unclear on that biblical reference and how it applies to Krampus precisely when he's not the devil, but who knows? These myths are so old that they have kind of morphed and twisted over time. They've been translated several times, so some things do get a little foggy with time. Some countries have St. Nicholas making his rounds on St. Nicholas Day or December 6th, making December 5th Krampusnacht, the night where the monster wanders freely, punishing children. The word Krampus comes from the word Krampen, which means claw. Ooh. Sometimes, as one human... No, I already told you that. One human foot, one cloven foot. Seems like you'd hear this guy coming, because it seems like he'd walk with, like, a limp. Who knows? Yeah, so really bad kids are sometimes also tortured, burned, or drowned instead of just eaten. In some versions, there are where Krampus will throw you in his sack and then just throw the sack in the river. Again, this is, to me at least, a better option than being taken to hell. Still not great, though. Not a lot of good choices here. I guess, though, you know, going back to choices and consequences, your choice occurred throughout the entire 11 and a half months prior, where you could have been making nice choices and not have to deal with Krampus. So there you go. At this point, your menu of options is fairly small. He's celebrated through all of Europe and is thought to have originally been a pagan god. Krampus loves schnapps, and it is a traditional gift to give him schnapps on December 5, or again, Krampusnacht. No word yet on whether a gift of schnapps will make him kind of look the other way as far as your sins throughout the entire year. I don't know, but apparently a lot of people give him schnapps because he is often depicted as being under the table, as having had a little too much. So I'm hoping that if you give him schnapps, it buys your way out of getting into his burlap sack. I don't know. Sometimes it's a basket. A basket or a burlap sack. But either way, once you're in that container of his, you're not going anywhere good. So if you're going to bribe him with alcohol, give it a shot, I guess. I didn't find any cases in myth where giving him schnapps as a bribe, again, saved you from a miserable fate. But apparently people are trying their luck because this guy is wasted a lot of the time. In the 1880s, Krampuskarten were very popular, which are Krampus greeting cards. It's a terrible idea. Instead of like a nice little card, I love you, Merry Christmas. Instead you get a Krampus card. Oh, that's terrible. People are sick. I say are and not were because yes, this was 1880, but people are no better now. But what a terrible... Can you imagine? Oh, look, I got a card from my grandma. That's terrible. Oh, I guess this is so funny to me, too, because today my husband got a Christmas card from his grandmother. I haven't looked at it yet. Hopefully it's not a Krampus card. It's just, oh, what a terrible thing. It's like an anti-Valentine's Day card. You were a brat this year. Here's your warning that you're getting dragged to hell by a monster. This is terrible. What an awful... It's an awful tradition, but it's so funny. It's funny if it's not what you believe in. I shouldn't be laughing. That's probably really irreverent. I'm sorry to anybody. But on the other hand, I don't think that Krampus has legitimately been like a religious figure in hundreds and hundreds of years, very similar to St. Nicholas. Like I said, he may have descended from kind of a pre-Christian god that was worshipped in the area of the world where he's most popular, but I don't think he's an actual religious figure anymore these days, so I only feel a little bit bad about laughing at it. The only people who are going to be offended by me laughing at Krampus are people who are still actually afraid of Krampus, I hope. Anyway, gosh, do not send me Krampus cards. That's so terrible. Eventually, Krampusnacht began to become a rowdy holiday, more about adults than about children. I hope so, if they're sending Krampus cards to people. Those sound way too scary to send to little kids. Reminds me of that Nightmare Before Christmas scene. What did Santa give you, honey? And he pulls his shrunken head out of the box. And in many ways, this does kind of track with being more similar to Halloween than Christmas. But that's crazy hilarious. In fact, even the whole adults kind of overtaking this holiday is similar to Halloween, because if you think Halloween used to be kind of a, at least when I grew up in the 90s and the late 80s, kind of a cute time when cute kids would dress up and go trick-or-treating, and now it's, you can't walk into a Halloween store without a bunch of inappropriately dressed lady costumes all over, you know? So it's like, I can see how this would evolve into a more sinful holiday than it originated as, because we're seeing that evolution today, just with a totally different holiday. So it became less and less about scaring kids into good behavior, and more about people dressing as Krampi? The plural gets a little vague when the word ends with S. I'm going to say Krampuses. I don't know. None of those pluralizations sound right or correct, but people would dress as Krampus, I'll put it that way, and would chase other people in the streets, drinking schnapps and beating people with birch rods. This is a terrible holiday. Oh my goodness. So in the 1930s, I'm going to try and straighten up and act right here, Austria tried to ban Krampus because things were understandably getting out of hand. People were getting injured in these December 5 beatings that were taking place on public streets. Krampus dances were banned. Krampus dances were a thing? Okay, well, Krampus dances were a thing, and then they were banned. That sounds terrible, too. Then it's not a very romantic dance. Let's go dress like stinky, sweaty goat men and dance. Ugh. Well, I guess if you drink enough schnapps, anything sounds fun. I don't know. I'm not a drinker myself. Even if you wore a Krampus costume, you'd be arrested on sight. That part seems a little bit of an overreaction. Like, I can see banning the chasing people down for schnapps and beating them in public, but wearing a costume seems fairly innocuous if you're not hurting anybody. But I guess they were trying to ban the whole situation across the board. So if you were dressed as Krampus, you'd be instantly arrested. Eventually, dress up at all around Christmas you needed a government license for, so they could make sure that you were a jolly old elf and not the Christmas demon. Good grief. After World War II, the tradition slowly came back. In 1953, a pamphlet went out reminding parents that Krampus was evil and would scar their kids for life. This went out from a local teacher, just kind of trying to keep that that ban in place. So I guess teachers' unions and teachers being pro-government control of everybody else's kids was a thing even back then. Go figure. Still, despite all of these, I'm going to say good intentions, still Krampus reemerged on the cultural mind, becoming more popular than ever. And so it's a kind of interesting. He's starting to become more popular again in at least our culture in America, despite being relatively unknown until a few years ago. There was some kind of Krampus horror comedy situation that was made and stuff like that. So he's becoming kind of a I don't want to say a big deal. He's not competing with St. Nicholas or anything like that, but he's just kind of becoming kind of a funny folklore monster, like werewolves and mummies, something to make movies out of but not take super seriously, at least here in the States. Now that I know that I have a lot of international listeners, I would love to hear kind of your perspective on this. Some of you are probably over there shaking your heads going, girl, don't you laugh at Krampus, he's gonna get you. And if that's your thoughts on the matter, I would be fascinated to hear more about what you're thinking right now. But yeah, so here, at least in the States, we don't take Krampus as anything that serious. Again, kind of another boogeyman tale to just kind of scare kids into behaving straight. It's manipulative, but if you look at a lot of these folklore and fairy tales and from all over the world, this form of manipulation of scaring kids into good behavior, it's worked for thousands of years, so I guess nobody's gonna stop doing it now. I don't know. Oh man. As a side note, I don't know how well dogs understand humans, but both of mine have been hiding under the table for this entire episode and while I was doing the research for it. So I may not be scared of Krampus. I may be up here having a chuckle, but the dogs at least are super uncomfortable with it. So I'm going to end their misery. And I don't know, they've been good. I won't sick the Christmas demon on them this year. I don't know. One of them's a little naughty. We'll see. We'll see. They would be shocked if there were ever consequences at all for being naughty. And on that note, I will see you next time for another Christmas episode. Have a wonderful Christmas. Be good. You know, clean your house. Don't get too much attention from Krampus. Have a good one. Hey everyone, welcome back to Southern Fried Storytime. I'm so excited to talk about today's subject, my guy, St. Nicholas. I've got to get a little excited about him because we have almost exactly the same name. My name is Nicole, which is of course the feminine version of Nicholas in this country, though sometimes that in some countries that's just how they pronounce Nicholas. So I get excited when it's time to talk about my name buddy, but I do want to give you a little warning before you listen to this episode. You know, just maybe give it a once over by yourself without your kiddos before you let them hear it. Some parts of the legend of St. Nicholas can get scary or violent or dark, and that's nothing new to this show, but some of you may not want your littles to think of Santa that way. Especially when, you know, he breaks into your house every year. You have a better idea of your children's threshold than I do, so just please give it a listen by yourself first, then you can decide if the episode is right for you. St. Nicholas was the 4th century bishop of Myra. He was born before, but lived mostly during, the reign of Emperor Constantine. Not the broody exorcist Keanu Reeves Constantine, but the Roman emperor who decriminalized Christianity. So part of his upbringing, it was illegal to be Christian, and yet he ended up a bishop. So talk about a turnaround in circumstances. Nicholas attended the Council of Nicaea in 325 and met a man who was spreading heresy about the divinity of Jesus Christ. Nicholas then punched him in the face like a boss. Guess that guy's on the naughty list. But he went to prison for it. I guess then, like now, you can only be violently passionate about your faith if that faith is not Christianity. If you're violently passionate about Christianity, you go to jail. Any other faith and you're a hero. Figure that one out. But apparently that's nothing new. Even though they took his clothes in his dreams, they were given back to him along with a volume of scripture. In the morning, the guard found him unchained and undressed. Spooky. Or sorry, not undressed, redressed. Unchained, redressed. Whole different context there. Okay, whew, interesting. When word of this got back to Emperor Constantine, he restored St. Nicholas's titles and position, and the emperor himself asked Nicholas for his forgiveness. He spent most of his life performing miracles and died on December 6, 343, which is why December 6 and not December 25th is St. Nicholas Day. He would eventually become the patron saint of, sit down and get comfortable for this one, children, sailors, merchants, reformed thieves, schoolboys, brewers, pawnbrokers, and more. Those are just the biggies. So, yeah, apparently when you're saint of a lot of things. I'm not Catholic, so that was new to me that you were the patron saint of lots of stuff instead of, I thought each kind of situation had its own separate saint, because I know that there's like a whole bunch of them. So, yeah, gotta go ahead and admit that I had no idea there. So, there you go. According to legend, there were many strange things about this bishop's life. Apparently, as a newborn, he stood up upright like an adult and thanked God during his first bath. I love baths as much as the next person, and I'm usually pretty grateful for them, but if my kid did this, I'd faint. No question. I'm hitting the floor. Holy cow, that's scary. As soon as he could walk, he was marching his way to church. The current bishop of Myra was told that when he died, the first person to enter the church would be named Nicholas, and he would be the new bishop. Imagine their surprise when it ended up being a child. He battled evil spirits, saved Myra from famine, and overall was a pretty fantastic bishop. Because his family was wealthy, they left him a lot of money, and he used that to sneak into people's houses and leave gifts. So again with the breaking and entering, though. Oh, well. One man had lost everything, and he had no money to pay for dowries for his three daughters, who would remain unmarried without a bride price. Their father could barely afford to feed them, and the only job for women back then was prostitution. Even if they didn't fall that far, people would assume a woman living and working alone was a prostitute or a witch anyway. So, either way, things looked pretty black. One night, the poor man was awakened by a heavy thud of a bag of money being flung through his window. He was shocked, but since whoever had given it to him had vanished, he used it to get the eldest daughter a good husband and thanked God. After a few years, the middle daughter was of age, and the same thing happened. On the third daughter, the man was determined to thank the man who had saved his family from ruin. When he saw someone throw the bag of money in his house, he tackled them, how's that for gratitude, only to find the bishop, St. Nicholas. Well, he wasn't St. Nicholas yet then, but, you know, that comes later. When the man tried to thank him, the bishop told him that any thanks should go to God. Nicholas then asked the grateful father to tell no one about what he had done, but as happens in all small towns and apparently Hogwarts, word got around fast. Another famous story centers around three young students on their way home. In some versions, they're on their way home from school, in some versions, they're on their way to school. Either way, they're on the road when they get lost after dark. They come upon a man that in some versions is said to be an innkeeper, in other versions it's a butcher. I've always heard this story told where he's a butcher, and they ask if they can stay the night. Since there was absolutely no one around for miles, he agreed. The famine had done a number on this man's business, and he didn't have much meat to sell or feed his family with when the boys said no one expected them for a few days, so they had to spend the night. The man locked them in. The butcher killed all three of them, robbed them of all of their belongings, and chopped them into little pieces of meat that he then put in barrels to brine in his basement. Told you to listen to this one before you had your kids listen. People disappeared all the time in those days, and no one came looking for him. 7 years later, Nicholas, the Bishop of Myra, was passing through, and the butcher offered the future saint the best of his meats. Nicholas knew exactly what meats the man had in his basement and asked for the meat that had been in brine for 7 years. The butcher fled while Nicholas pried open the barrel and touched the water with three fingers. The boys leaped out, fully reassembled like the Avengers, and were alive once more. Nicholas's generosity became the stuff of legend, and for a long time he was seen as a very stern but generous gift giver. Because of his love for children, the saint started to be depicted as bringing a servant or companion with him to be the disciplinarian to Nicholas's benefactor. Protestants were not enthusiastic about showing reverence for a Catholic saint. This is not a super big deal here in America, but I know that there have been huge portions of history where Catholic versus Protestant was a great big old deal in Europe. And I'm assuming that there are some small bits of that here as well, since a lot of America comes directly from European tradition, but you really don't see much animosity between Catholicism and Protestantism here. So I suppose that context is a little bit different when you're not on this continent. St. Nicholas. Yeah, so these Protestants that didn't want to worship St. Nicholas began the tradition of the baby Jesus bringing gifts on Christmas Eve rather than on December 6th, St. Nicholas Day. This baby Jesus also came with a companion to do the punishing part for the bad children, and often these companions bore a strong resemblance to Krampus, with a stick to drag the with a sack to drag the bad kids away in, and a stick to beat them with. Later, this figure became more gentle, leaving a lump of coal and or a switch for the parents to be the deliverers of the discipline instead of the evil companion of, in this case, baby Jesus. Now, my thought is, if the parents were delivering that discipline in the first place, there would be no need for the kids to receive said switch, but, you know, it was a different time. Who knows? There are many depictions of Saint Nick as he has been influenced many times by the local pagan beliefs when Christians came to town, so much so that many current-day Christians lump him right in with other secular Christmas traditions. In fact, you often hear that complaint in Christian circles, that Santa Claus is just as part of the secular Christmas celebration as Gingerbread Man and all of that. A lot of people don't even consider the bishop, the saint, and Santa Claus the same character anymore because he has transformed so much over the hundreds and hundreds of years that his story has been told. Which makes sense, because think about comparatively young story of Rapunzel and how much it has changed since its original telling. I mean, we've gone over that one until we're blue in the face, 5 whole episodes, and 3 different versions written several years apart are totally, totally different. And this is an even older story, so it makes sense to see that he's changed quite a bit over time. The stern bishop has become a distant memory. Some legends state that the Norse god Odin was the first Santa Claus, as he would give swords to his warriors. But really, the only gifts we see are Odin giving swords to his warriors. He's not giving gifts to any of the common people or the women or the children or anything like that. And let's be real, for a warrior king, giving swords to your warriors is really directly advantageous to you. So I'm not sure how generous it is, really. But okay, you know, a lot of people are pretty, especially proponents of St. Nicholas / Santa Claus being a strictly secular figure, a lot of people point to Odin as being where he's derived from. Never mind that he was an actual, like, human person. Again, a lot of that has been just kind of lost over time. I don't think lost as in people are unaware of it. I think it's been lost over time in the sense that people just don't give it much thought. There are a lot of things that people know, but they really don't think about, you know, just like St. Patrick's Day. People think about it being a holiday with green and shamrocks and stuff like that. Very few people think about the actual saint upon whom that day is based. And I think in a very similar way, this kind of works that way too, where it's one of those things that everybody knows it, but nobody really thinks about it enough to have it be an active part of our consciousness. Kind of like when you sit in a chair, you assume that chair is going to hold you. You know, you don't actually ponder, is this a good idea? How much do I know about this chair? A lot of our current view of Saint Nick comes from the Dutch, German, and English traditions coming to early America and bringing their Christian traditions with them, where they merged. I love some of the German Christmas traditions, which, as you'll hear in my Christmas Carol episode, have a good deal of influence on some of the Christian traditions not being lost in England. I even love going to Aldi and seeing all the winter knocked Christmas food and Christmas stuff that they have directly from Europe. I can't pronounce any of them. Like, I pronounce exactly none of it correctly, but I try every year, and it's fun, and it's fascinating to see how different countries have different food and different imagery and stuff like that surrounding Christmas. I had a Christmas candy from Aldi yesterday, which means it was either from Germany or Switzerland, probably Germany. Aldi is a Germany-based company. And It was like chocolate covered marzipan, which basically is just almond flavored paste, right? And I was surprised. It was very, very different from a traditional Christmas food that you would usually have here in the States. It wasn't bad. It was just very different. It was very sweet. I don't think I'd get it again just because it was so sweet. Maybe if they put some nuts or some salt in there to kind of calm it down. And this is an American saying that it was a candy that was too sweet, you guys. So brace yourselves. That's a sweet one. But I think it's interesting because it's something we think of as, you know, one of the few touch points where a huge portion of the world celebrates this same holiday. So it's kind of funny to think of the different ways in which we celebrate it. In some countries that are largely without much Christian influence, you know, Christmas is a day to go to KFC. I do not know how that became a thing. That culture thought that that's what Americans do on Christmas. It's not. Nobody goes to KFC at Christmas here. Honestly, most of us don't go to KFC if we can avoid it on any day, let alone Christmas. But Christmas usually is a day for a big home-cooked meal with your whole family, but somehow word got around that that's the American Christmas tradition, is to have KFC, and this culture went hog for it. I don't know. That seems weirdly specific, but no, most Americans don't have Kentucky Fried Chicken on Christmas. If we have fried chicken at all, it's usually fried by, like, your grandmother, you know? And even then, that's never what we did at my house growing up. So that just seemed like such a bizarre Christmas tradition to me. But at the same time, again, this is a holiday that cultures from all over the world celebrate it, but we all celebrate it in completely different ways. So if KFC is your thing, go for it. I don't know. I always feel sleepy and gross after eating KFC, even when it's not Christmas. So it's just not my thing. It tastes good, but you're usually sorry, you know, within an hour. You get like a headache. I don't know if anybody else gets like a headache from really processed cooking oils, but I've found lately that I do. So I try not to mess around with that too much. It's all the soy, man. It's all that soy. Anyway, the name Santa Claus is thought to come from the Dutch Sinterklaas, which we see a nod to in the original Miracle on 34th Street movie. Gotta say, the original one in black and white is definitely the better of the two movies, at least in this humble podcaster's opinion. I tend to like the classic version of things better than the newer version of things myself anyway. It's just kind of as a whimsical, nostalgic person, it's just kind of how I am. Once in a while, the new version of things will impress me more than I thought it would, but for Miracle on 34th Street, I'm sticking with the original being the better version. And in that version, you see Santa Claus talking to a little Dutch girl in Dutch. In the newer version, they modernize it and make it ASL, American Sign Language. But I thought it was a great kind of nod back to the little girl tells her mother that he is Sinterklaas. And a lot of people think that it's kind of a westernized mispronunciation of Sinterklaas that led to Santa Claus. And it really is the closest to any of St. Nicholas's names that I've actually heard be close to Santa Claus. And Klaus or Klaus actually means Nicholas. It's how you pronounce Nicholas in some other countries. And again, when I say other countries, I'm here in the U.S., so anybody else, you're another country. The name Kris Kringle comes from a mispronunciation of Christkindl or Christkinder, which again is the Protestant version where baby Jesus stepped in instead of Santa. So we see two different Christmas traditions, both Catholic and Protestant, merging into this one character of Kris Kringle / Santa Claus. Very interesting. Again, that's kind of, given the animosity in early days between Catholics and Protestants, I'm going to go ahead and assume that this is the kind of change that can only take place over the course of several centuries, because it's kind of hard to merge baby Jesus and St. Nicholas, who was a follower of baby Jesus, into one person. It seems like an interesting stretch, and it must have taken just generations for something like that to happen. And of course, the merging of Catholicism and Protestantism, which again, were very hostile to each other for hundreds of years. So I think much less so now. And I think that's part of what has made this merge of the two characters possible. In 1823, a poem would be written that would change perception of the saint once again all over the world. 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. This poem transformed Nicholas into a large, jolly elf rather than a stern but generous saint. And this image would travel outward from America as St. Nicholas's previous earlier incarnations had traveled inward to America. So we took kind of all of these interesting versions of this saint from Europe, mixed them all together, wrote a super pretty poem about it that kind of made it an Americanized version and then cast it back out into the world. Now, if you've ever had like an Americanized version of cuisine from your own country or even your own part of the country, you know that this happens with food all the time, but it's kind of weird to see it happen with with a legend of an actual saint. I mean, I've had gumbo at places where parts of the country where gumbo has no business being because they're not southern spicy places, and it's not at all the same as the gumbo you'd get like here in Charleston or in New Orleans. So it's a more gentle, palatable, kind of hybridized version of it. And that's kind of what we did with Santa. We took in legends of Santa from all over the world, whipped them into one frothy, sugar-sweet concoction, and cast them right back at the world. It's strange to consider a stern priest who grew up in a time when Christianity was illegal and martyrdom was a constant threat to become a symbol of joviality and plenty. I'm pretty sure the actual Saint Nicholas was not big and chubby and rosy-cheeked. After all, having enough food to survive on during times of famine was a big issue that he faced a lot in his lifetime. So having him be this big, chubby, kind of jolly figure is a little bit strange, but again, it's had hundreds and hundreds of years for this legend to change so much. If you like this podcast and liked learning a little bit more about St. Nicholas, please like, subscribe, rate and review it, share it on your favorite podcast platform. You can also engage with the podcast on Facebook, Twitter, or southernfriedstorytime.wordpress.com. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you have another take on the legend of St. Nicholas, I would love to hear more from you. So please do engage on any of the sites I mentioned, and I'll look forward to hearing from you soon. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Southern Fried Story Time. Today we're going to discuss two different versions of the Nutcracker. We're going to talk about the Nutcracker and the Mouse King book by E.T.A. Hoffman versus the Nutcracker Ballet. Both the ballet and the story by Hoffman begin on Christmas Eve, where the Stahlbaum family are receiving gifts and giving gifts out to all of the children. And at one point, the clock, with an owl sitting on top of it, a great big grandfather clock, strikes 8, and the mysterious Drosselmeyer enters the room. He was a talented clockmaker, inventor, toy maker, and magician who made lifelike clockwork toys that were marvels to the children. In the book, the kids are not quite as enchanted by these clockwork inventions. Since they are clockwork, they can only repeat the same motions over and over. Think about the toys at the beginning of Pinocchio. You know, they can only repeat a few different movements. I don't know why that bothers them. I still think clockwork things are still pretty cool. But anyway, the kids get bored with them pretty quickly, and Drosselmeyer is pretty salty about it, but he presents Clara, or in some versions, Marie, with a nutcracker. She is dazzled by it, but her brother Fritz tries to put a nut into its mouth that's much too big and breaks the nutcracker's jaw. Clara is devastated and uses a ribbon from her dress to wrap his wound. Later that night, Clara is putting away all of her new toys when the clock strikes midnight, and suddenly mice swarm into the room like water. The Nutcracker raises an army of gingerbread men and Fritz's tin soldiers. In the ballet, the Nutcracker morphs into human size, but the book doesn't really mention whether he stays nutcracker size or human size. I'm going to assume he stays normal size because that seems like it'd be noteworthy, right? The soldiers fight valiantly, but the mice seem to be infinite, and they're about to win when Clara takes off her shoe and throws it at the seven-headed Mouse King. He knocks her backwards into the Nutcracker's glass case, but the strike injures him and startles him, and he and his horde run off. Clara, on the other hand, was cut badly by the glass and faints from blood loss. In the ballet, her shoe toss simply distracts the Mouse King, and the prince is able to, the Nutcracker that is, stab and wound him, and then the Mouse King's party all retreat. In the ballet, we skip ahead quite a bit, so I'm going to focus on the book for just now. While Clara, or Marie, in the book it's Marie, in the play it's Clara, recovers from her injury for a few days, Drosselmeyer returns to check on her. When she told him what she had seen, he told her some backstory on the Nutcracker. In the kingdom of the Princess Pirlipat, her father, the king, wanted sausages for dinner. The queen was the only one who knew the recipe, but while she was adding the lard, everything went wrong. From near her feet, she heard the voice of the tiny mouse queen, Lady Mouserinx. She asked if she could have some of the fat for herself and her family. The sympathetic queen agreed before hundreds of mice who had been hiding emerged from and ate every bit of the fat. This ruined the king's dinner. If you've ever tried sausage, they always add fat to it, whether it's pork or turkey or whatever, because it just makes it more palatable. And so this would make it basically a tube of leather. And so he called upon his court inventor, Drosselmeyer, to make mouse traps for the mouse queen and her children. When a whole generation of mice had been killed, the Mouse Queen swore vengeance on the royal family. The best way to get revenge on someone is to hurt their children. So Mouserinx struck Princess Pirlipat with a horrible curse of ugliness. She grew her massive head and gray beard and short white hair. In other words, she looked just like a nutcracker. The king blamed Drosselmeyer and ordered him to find a cure. Using magic, they found the only cure was to eat a small nut called a krakatuk. Apparently this is a thing. And it had to be cracked by a man who had never shaved and never worn boots in his life. I would assume that means a baby, but that's just me. He needs to crack the nut with his teeth, give it to the princess without opening his eyes, and take seven steps backwards without stumbling. Man, I can't take seven steps without stumbling with my eyes open. I'm super clumsy, so this is quite a task. The men journey for 15 years before finding the nut, and the king's promise of the princess's hand soon brings out the young man they need. The princess was given the nut by the man who cracked it easily. It's a little gross that he cracks it in his mouth and feeds it to her, but whatever. And she returns to her beautiful self, delighted by the young man before her. All seemed well as the handsome young man carefully stepped backwards with his eyes shut. But Lady Mouserinx would not have it. She ran underfoot, forcing the young man to stumble, getting herself crushed in the process. The young man was Drosselmeyer's nephew, and he watched helpless as the boy fell and was himself a nutcracker by the time he hit the floor. The Princess Pirlipat is revolted by his new looks and refuses to marry him despite looking the exact same way literally a few minutes ago. So this girl is super vain. And she even banished the Nutcracker from her kingdom. Super ungrateful. Oh, it seems a little extreme. Like, you're not pretty to look at, so get out of my whole kingdom. Good grief. I mean, not marrying someone you're not attracted to is one thing, but banishing them when they saved your life? This girl's ridiculous. Oh my goodness. But, you know, maybe she's a narcissist. I'm not a psychologist, but a classic symptom of narcissism is caring much more what things and people look like around you. And, you know, they care about how you look because of how it reflects on them. I was watching a video of a woman who is a personal trainer now, but when she was a young girl, her father wouldn't even let her walk with him in the mall if she hadn't put like enough lotion on her legs that day and her skin was ashy, because he was so ashamed of what that ashy skin, how that reflected on him. Some people are just ridiculous. I don't know. I've never thought that the looks of the people around me reflected upon me personally, but a lot of people are like that. And it is a classic sign of narcissism, so there is something to be said there, but it wouldn't be too shocking for this princess to be a narcissist, because, I don't know, she's promised to marry him, she's all for it, and then the minute he looks a little different, I don't know. It's very, very vain, selfish, shallow, a lot of insults for a person like that, right? While recovering from her injury, this is back with Marie / Clara, the son of Lady Mouserinx, the seven-headed Mouse King, demands sweets and food from Clara every night, otherwise he'll destroy her beloved Nutcracker. When she can no longer meet his demands, the Nutcracker asks for her for a sword. She borrows one from one of Fritz's toys, and the Nutcracker kills the Mouse King. With a sword dripping with blood, he delivers the seven crowns of the Mouse King to Clara. He takes her to his own kingdom, the Kingdom of Dolls, where she sees many wonderful things, and eventually she wakes back up in her own bed, where no one believes what she's seen. Finally, we're back to the ballet, because we finally caught up to where the ballet is. Clara's shoe distraction allowed the prince to kill the Mouse King on the first attempt in this version, and he turned back into a human just upon killing the Mouse King. So his Nutcracker state has a lot to do with the Mouse King in this one, as opposed to needing to win the love of a maiden. Lost my place. Ah, here we go. He led Clara through the beautiful pine forest to his kingdom, the Land of Sweets. So instead of the Land of Dolls in the ballet, he lives in the Land of Sweets. The Sugar Plum Fairy has been ruling the land in her prince's place, kind of like a regent. And now that he's back, she throws a massive party to celebrate his return. All of the sweets and flowers dance for Clara and the prince, and then he takes Clara back home. In the book, Marie tells her godfather Drosselmeyer, the only one who believes her, that if the Nutcracker could be human, she would never reject him like Princess Pirlipat. There was a loud bang, and she fainted, only for her mother to wake her up, telling her that Drosselmeyer's nephew had arrived from Nuremberg. Here we see the book and most versions of the ballet end with her marrying the Nutcracker and being crowned as his queen. In the book, Queen of the Land of Dolls, in the ballet, Queen of the Land of Sweets. So there's a lot of similarities between the two. We definitely get a lot more backstory on how the Nutcracker came to be a Nutcracker in the book. The ballet was adapted by André Dumas, the author of The Count of Monte Cristo, and so he decided to take some of the darker elements of the book and kind of wipe that away a little bit to make the ballet a little more palatable. Of course, as we've discussed before when talking about Sleeping Beauty, the music is by Tchaikovsky. Often the Nutcracker Ballet and the Nutcracker Suite, which is featured in Disney's Fantasia, was at the time that Fantasia came out the first exposure to Russian music that many Americans actually had. We weren't on the best of terms with Russia at that point. I don't think we've ever really been on the best of terms with Russia. And so a lot of people just kind of overlooked that cultural part of Russia, that beautiful music. And so often the first Russian music or music of Tchaikovsky that people over here in America at least are exposed to are either Disney's Sleeping Beauty or the Nutcracker Suite, which originally people, like I said, had greatest exposure to with Fantasia. But since then, the Nutcracker Ballet, especially I think post-1960, has become much more popular in the United States around Christmas as a Christmas time tradition as well. So while it's kind of common to be exposed to this particular music, especially at this time of year today, it's always kind of a little surprising to me that some people's first exposure to Tchaikovsky would be Sleeping Beauty or Fantasia. It's hard to imagine that being so, because it seems like so many people take their kids or even just their daughters to see the Nutcracker. My mother took me when I was little, and so it's kind of crazy to me to think that it hasn't always been that way. So that was kind of my comparison between the Nutcracker and the Mouse King, the book, and the Nutcracker Ballet. The ballet obviously has a lot more specific imagery, like Mother Ginger and her children that come out from under her hoop skirts, and you get to see the Sugar Plum Fairy dance a little more, whereas in the book we are just told that she was kind of the regent and watching over the kingdom while the prince was gone. So it's kind of interesting. Now, we know that Disney a couple years ago did a kind of modernized version of the Nutcracker, which was not really a musical per se. It does feature a ballet in it, which is kind of a nod to in the book when the Sugar Plum Fairy throws the party for the Nutcracker Prince. We see a lot of the residents of his kingdom doing a dance or a ballet for them and stuff like that. One of the mice in the Disney version is called Mouserinks. So we get a lot of nods to both the ballet and to the original book in this version. Though, of course, Disney's super on this twist villain kick right now, so they had to mix up the stories a little bit, and they made it unique. They probably just didn't want... They wanted people to come see it without it being predictable how it would happen, since it's become so much more common in our culture to be aware of this particular play slash ballet. I'm going to take a sip of tea a second here. I'm talking my voice away. But, yeah, since people are much more aware of the story, I think Disney threw in a twist just to make it a little bit more interesting. But there are nods throughout the newer telling to both the book and the ballet, which made that a little bit more interesting. Except for the fact that they state specifically in both the book and the ballet that the Nutcracker, in his Nutcracker form, is very ugly, and that he's only extremely handsome in his human form. If you look at this kid in, I don't know who the boy is they got to play the Nutcracker in the Disney version, but he doesn't have both a human and a Nutcracker form. You just see him in one form, and this kid is beautiful. I don't know. I don't know who thought that this was an ugly looking Nutcracker. The only thing Nutcrackery about him is his kind of soldier uniform. Other than that, he doesn't look like a Nutcracker at all. He doesn't have, like, the weird-shaped eyes and the weird grin and the grizzly whiskers. This is a gorgeous little boy. I don't know where they found... I shouldn't say little boy. He's probably, like 18 now. Disney likes to cast people to play characters that are a lot younger than the actor is, so he's probably a fully grown adult or whatever now. But, yeah, that was one thing that kind of made me stumble while watching the newer Disney version, is that he doesn't look like a Nutcracker. He just has a Nutcracker outfit. So that was kind of interesting. But yeah, I don't know. Keira Knightley did an excellent job. I just don't like the particular storyline and twist villain. I think she did a great job doing it. I don't know what she did to her voice there. She has a beautiful voice. So to have it changed in such a way was a little jarring. But she did a great job. I'm just not a big fan of the twist villains at this point, because now you're expecting it. And I think of this particular ballet is such a classic story, and as I said, my mother took me to see it when I was so little, that I don't like people changing it. I don't like compromising older materials. I think a lot of people try to twist and modernize older versions of fairy tales and stories, and they think that that makes them creative. Twisting and polluting something old that somebody else created doesn't make you creative. Creating something on your own is creative. So I do get a little frustrated when they're like, oh, we're going to modernize Beauty and the Beast. We're going to modernize the Nutcracker. Well, okay, but you're not being creative when you're not creating something of your own. So I do get a little frustrated with all of these remakes that then they clap their hands for themselves and tell them, look how creative I am. No, because you didn't create anything. It's literally the same word, create, creative. I don't have a doctorate in linguistics, but I'm pretty sure I've got this one figured out. You have to create something of your own to be creative. And so I like the visuals in the newer Nutcracker. I think it looks very wintry and Christmassy and pretty. I thought the actors did a great job. Again, Keira Knightley and Morgan Freeman is always fantastic. That man has the most soothing voice on planet Earth. But I don't think it's the Nutcracker, I guess is my complaint. They use the same music and the same characters, but it's kind of a Nutcracker fanfic rather than an actual Nutcracker. They made Mother Ginger the villain somehow instead of somebody that, you know, participates in the dance, and then the twist at the end is she isn't the villain, and I don't know. It's a very interesting story with very pretty visuals, but it's not the Nutcracker. If you want your kids to see the actual Nutcracker, I recommend taking them to the ballet. Even if you can't go to, like, a fancy production of the ballet, lots of times local schools and stuff will do some version of the ballet. I wouldn't necessarily read them the story unless they're a little older. Excuse me. Because it is a little spooky. Sorry, I'm recording the fourth podcast in a row, so my voice is telling me it's done. But definitely take them to see the classic. Thank you for tuning in with me, and have a great day. Hey everyone, it's me again from the future. Literally just the next day after I recorded the Nutcracker, I just wanted to end the episode with kind of an apology and give you a little peek behind the curtain here. Usually what I do with these episodes is I'll do the research and write out the script for probably 3 or 4 of them at a time, and then I kind of record them all at once in a batch. And, you know, you never record all in one stretch. You end up kind of recording and re-recording and re-recording parts that didn't work or parts that just didn't sound right or where the sound didn't all go through. So you end up recording quite a bit longer than the final show ends up being. And then when you're recording 3 or 4 episodes at once, you end up recording like 4 or 5 hours at once. And at the end of the Nutcracker episode, my voice was just not having it anymore. It decided it was going on strike. And so you hear a couple long pauses there at the end where I'm getting a drink of water or a drink of tea, and I'm trying to hide, you know, the sound of that and trying not to like swallow and slurp in a way that's going to be obnoxious or rude for the listener. And my voice still was not forgiving me for that abuse. So I did kind of peace out of that episode pretty quick, and I just wanted to come on and just kind of apologize for how abruptly I ended it, because that always does feel very rude to just sharply cut things off. I wasn't trying to say not to see the Disney Nutcracker. I'm just saying that I would, if you're taking especially children, since Nutcracker has become kind of part of Christmas tradition and Christmas culture, just take them to see the original ballet and get them familiar with that first, before you see Disney's kind of twisted, modernized version of it. It's still very pretty visuals, very wintry and Christmassy. It's lovely to look at, and it is an interesting turn on the story, but it is not what I would classically think of as the Nutcracker. So I would just, for the sake of your kids being culturally familiar with the original story, I probably wouldn't read them the book because it does get a little scary, but just familiarizing them with the play and the music. The Disney version does utilize a lot of that same music from the ballet, but it just has a very different storyline. And so just to keep the purity of your kids understanding what the actual story of the Nutcracker is, I would make sure that they were more familiar with the ballet first. That being said, the Disney version is beautiful. The actors and actresses involved do a fantastic job with the characters that they're given. It's just not the traditional Nutcracker. And so if you want your kids to understand that story and the countries it comes from and the history it has, you have to take them to see that story and not the twist on that story. And that's all I'm saying. Very much how Disney's version of Snow White is not Snow White, and Disney's version of Cinderella is not Cinderella. And so just kind of basically the purpose of this podcast is keep people familiar with the origins of these classic, beautiful, beautiful stories. But yeah, there are a lot of beautiful winter landscapes and everything in that movie, and I was definitely not trying to cut things off really sharply and sound very rude and dismissive towards the end of the podcast. It's just my voice had decided to retire for the day, and now, you know, the next day when I've had a little water and a couple cups of tea, it's feeling better now, but I do every now and then record until my voice is just done. And I'm sure you guys have heard me do it a couple of times. Pretty much any time where there's a long pause in the recording on the podcast, I'm getting a drink of water or tea. And so it was such a sharp, abrupt ending to this episode that I definitely wanted to come back and apologize. And again, give you a look at how I do these, and it'll probably explain some of the pauses that you've heard in the past as well. It just means that that was one of the ones that I recorded towards the end of the day, and my voice has decided that it's going to bed. But thanks for tuning in anyway, and thanks for tuning in for the Christmas season. I hope you all have a wonderful, wonderful Christmas, and I really did regret not having the vocal strength to tell you that at the end of the last episode, because I do hope you have a wonderful, beautiful Christmas, and I do appreciate you tuning into this show several times a week just to hear me talk about the stories that I love so much, and I hope that you'll love them too. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to do that. I never thought I would get to do something like this, and I really do enjoy every moment of it. And I hope that you too. Have a Merry Christmas, and I can't wait to talk to you again.